Welcome to Black Armada Tales, an actual play podcast. My name is Nick, and my pronouns are he, him.
Hello, I'm Becky Anderson. My pronouns are she, her.
And I'm James Torrance. My pronouns are he, him.
My name is Josh. My pronouns are he, him.
Hi, my name's Sue Elliott. My pronouns are she, her.
And today we're playing Stealing the Throne. So, the alert level goes down one. This could potentially be very significant for the getaway. Sue, you're tossing in your cards. So, you won't be able to help anyone out as backup, and you won't feature in the getaway. That, of course, doesn't mean you're out of the game. You can still contribute. I mean, your character can even contribute in flashbacks and all those kinds of things. There's no reason why you need to log off and go home. You're still here. But we have one last scene to go, one final scene before we hopefully secure the throne. And in this final scene, I will be playing the throne and James will be the thief by definition. So fade along with the mournful music as Larrick makes her noble sacrifice so that we can get that sword back to the homeworld, the lush, luxurious homeworld of House Tetsudo and the bay where Tensword stands. All of this rich, flamboyant opulence and all the rest of it. And so initially there's a visual of something that looks beautiful and calm in comparison to the battle that we just witnessed. But then you hear the drumming of feet and the calling of guards to each other as they spread out throughout the streets of the capital. Word has got out that somebody has been collecting swords. Now, had it not been for that noble sacrifice, they would know who. But thanks to Larrick, there are no... Somebody's doing it. Something's happening with these swords, but who knows what. But House Tetsudo, always careful. Always need to be sure that the pride of their empire, the thing that has made them great, is safe. So they've deployed guards throughout the streets of the harbour surrounding this bay, who are patrolling and just making sure there's a presence known. And as the camera pans up from one of these guards in ornate red and gold imperial armor, as ostentatious as it is protective, wandering through the streets, just generally making their presence known, we see Tensword. And then the camera pans up a little bit further and we see a second Tensword, and then a third Tensword, and then a fourth. They have activated the hard light hologram systems that cause not one, two, three, or four extra Tensords, but nine extra Tensords to appear at various places around the harbour. And so this is the scene that greets Dimitri. I think probably the camera pans down to somebody who might be Dimitri as he looks up and sees 10 Tensords arrayed in front of him. One of them is the true throne, and there are guards everywhere. How's he going to figure it out and get inside? So, I need to deal some cards. Oh, the face-up card is a 3 of hearts. A lowly 3. And there are 3 more face-down cards.
I thought you put the alert level down.
Yeah, it went down from 4 to 3.
Jeez, I didn't realise it got that high.
In fact, maybe if we want to... Unless you have a particular desire for Dimitri to be off-world or something at the start of this scene, maybe the beginning of this scene, a squadron of 3 guards is moving towards Dimitri and one of them goes, "You there! Identification papers."
So where are we? We're in the streets of...
of the harbour city. Yep.
And seeing that they're too close to be evaded, Dimitri says, "These are my identification papers," and opens up his jacket, revealing firstly his bare chest with, you know, a tattoo of Morrigan with a big version of the sword in it, and Morrigan, never forget, vengeance forever, and other elaborate Art Deco Morrigan-esque tattoos. And also inside the jacket are his 10 swords, which, as we previously established, will do a miniature version of Ibbot's defense protocol. And even now, they power up, going zoom, 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 one by one, and fly out of the jacket and begin swirling around him in a whirling maze of blades controlled by his cybernetic implants.
I think the second of the 3 guards shouts, that's Ibbot's defense protocol in miniature! And all 3 of them swing their rifles, their laser rifles up, and open fire at Dimitri.
Great. 3 of the blades parry the laser blasts, and the rest of the blades go whirling towards them while Dimitri says, "Yes, here in the city that entombed Ibbet himself, you will have the privilege of being slain by his greatest creation." As the blades whirl through the air towards his assailants.
And I think probably just embed themselves in all three of them so that all three of them go down. But this has created a ruckus, and so guards are converging on your spot. And the camera is positioned just so that maybe over your shoulder, so that as these three guards get taken down by your swords, you can see three or four of the 10 swords on the horizon in front of you.
Sweet. So Dimitri has been sort of controlling, puppeteering the swords with a series of like complicated dance-like gestures, and even now he sort of closes a fist and draws it towards himself, and the swords that are embedded in the three guards, you know, pop out of their still warm corpses and fly back towards him. And then immediately he makes a rush towards one of the guards that stood on the edge of the harbour, with waves crashing against the edge of the harbour many metres below.
Has this guard seen you coming?
Oh yeah, stealth's not really Dimitri's thing.
No, I think that's fair.
You don't say.
Okay, I think this guard throws one hand up to his head, and you can see him in the universal signal of "I'm radioing somebody," and shouts into his comm, "Intruder converging on my position," as he blazes away one-handed with his laser rifle in your direction.
The blasts from his laser rifle are parried by one sword after another, 10 in a row, until finally Dimitri sort of bull rushes him, the rugby tackles him off the edge of the bay. The two of them go plunging down towards the water. As they fall, the swords reassemble themselves back in Dimitri's jacket. The guard is knocked unconscious by the impact from the water. Dimitri releases him and breathes easily with his surgically implanted gills and activates the turbine underwater propeller thing inbuilt into his jacket, which, you know, automatically shifts to become a streamlined underwater gear, and jets, hopefully, safe beneath the protection of the waves towards the nearest 10 sword, or is it?
Is this the pivotal moment? Are you taking a guess on which is the correct 10 sword, or do you have a? You're just going to fight your way through everyone until you...
I think I've got sensors inbuilt. If I can get close enough to a 10 sword, I'll be able to diagnose whether it's a true 10 sword or a holographic 10 sword with the sensor array built into my skull. But I've got to make it through the opposition to get close enough to one after the other.
Nice. Okay, I think we'll... So as you're zooming through the water heading towards this one, and I think we're getting close to the pivotal moment, it feels like to me. But I think one of the orbital defense lasers that stands guard over the capital of House Tetsudo has reoriented in this time. And though the individual laser blasters of the guards are completely ineffective shooting into the water, the just a column of light spears its way into the harbor next to you. So, yeah. Is this the moment?
Excellent. I start swimming in an evasive zigzag pattern towards the nearest 10 sword, and I play a 10. That beats a 3, and we've seen all the high cards in this deck.
10 is currently beating a 3.
There's only one ace, right?
Okay. I flipped the first card, and it is a queen. The second is a 10. Ties going to the throne. And the third of the face-down cards is a queen. So the alert level ticks up to 4, and the situation gets more complicated. So as Dimitri is propelled towards the nearest 10 sword with his scanners deployed to see if this is in fact the correct one, the sword that the throne wields in the harbor, the Throne Slayer, the last sword in the hands of Ten Slayer, just pierces down through the water and embeds itself in the ground next to Dimitri, who kind of dives out of the way to get out of the way from this sword coming through the ground. His senses indicate this is not the true Ten Sword. However, those hard-like holograms, they're just as capable of slicing you in half as an actual sword. And so that one then gets dragged out of the muck in the harbor, and another one buries itself in the muck next to you as one of the other hard-like Ten Swords, or maybe it's the real one, comes over to try and pierce you underground, under the water. You have the same three choices. Are you going to go out in a blaze of glory? Are you going to ask for assistance, or are you going to betray the rest of the crew?
So if I go for betrayal, then narratively remind me how that works. Well, I feel on the one hand, like, it doesn't really feel like that's Dimitri's thing. On the other hand, variety. So I don't know. I'm just
he's got himself a whole chest tattoo as a cunning bluff.
It's a long con. It's a very long con.
Is it like there's a little patch of fake skin which when you peel it away it reveals the word not.
So for completeness sake, were you to decide to betray us, you would draw one card, any card, but really you'd pick a high one, of the thrones into your hand, and then describe to us all how somehow this obstacle just melts away. Now, as far as the rest of the thieves are concerned, you're just very good at your job and you've managed to defeat the obstacle. We, the players, of course, know that you've betrayed us. Then come the getaway, you'll have an opportunity to step in and try and screw it up for the thieves while they make their escape, if you choose to betray us.
It doesn't feel like Dimitri's thing. How many people have we got that could assist still? And it wouldn't take much of a card. So,
a three would be enough.
Also, I think I turned traitor when we were last playing this, so you know.
You did.
There's that element of variety as well. So on balance, I will call for assistance. Can anyone help the ever loyal Dimitri Rostov?
I can help, and since I'm basically just going to be trashed in the last getaway anyway. I might as well give you the chance. So, I will give you my six.
That'll do it.
Thank you.
And then, how do you help?
Oh, flashback. Just before Dimitri sets off on the mission, Pandemonium presses into Dimitri's hand a small box with a very clear button that says press on it, because Pandemonium isn't entirely clear on how technologically savvy Dimitri is, so she doesn't want to take any risks on that. And she says, if they deploy any hard light measures, then this is a disruptor. Should get you out of a fix. Don't use it until you absolutely have to, though. We don't want them knowing we have this tech.
That does the job, so it's over to you, James.
Okay, as the blades, you know, multiple blades are slicing through the water. Dimitri, the sensors in his head are showing, you know, at this range, which of them are hard light, but equally he knows that won't save him from their cutting power. So it's time. So he reaches into, flips open the inside of his left arm for the storage compartment surgically inserted in there, and pulls out, even as blade slices meters away from him, swirling up the turbulent water, and presses the button marked press. Becky, you want to narrate what that does to hard light?
Yes, I do. So I think that it sends out a disruption field which turns hard light into just light. And so what happens is that as the swords hit solid objects, including hitting Dimitri as they would have done, instead of piercing him and just slicing him in twain, they instead burst into a shower of sparkly little fireworks around him. But he is lit up like a Christmas tree. And it is very obvious the hard light has failed, and who made it fail, since he's now covered in sparkly bits of light. That's you, Dimitri. You look like a sparkly vampire.
Who also knows exactly which of these is the true throne now.
Okay, are we saying that that constitutes the...
If you've got more, go for it.
Well, I think the, you know, orbital battle laser can now, its targeting systems are fully trained on him. It's not troubled about blowing up the disrupted hard light holograms. And, you know, we see it in space rotating slightly and heading up to full power. You know, the little lasers converge on the big lasery bit. But then Dimitri uses his cybernetic implants to trigger his turbo boost, drawing on the last of his own metabolic reserves to head at incredible speed, like a bullet through the water, the underwater G-forces ripping at his face, scouring away the surface of his tattoo, losing several of the swords ripped out of his jacket by the force of the waves, but he's able to outpace that laser, you know, as it burns through the water behind him in his wake as he converges on the position of the one true ten sword.
Love it. All right, and that concludes the heist. It's time for the getaway. And what happens in the getaway is this plays out as a sort of rapid-fire action montage where each of the surviving thieves will have a chance to face down an obstacle. Now, our alert level is 4. This heist went sideways. So the way the getaway is going to go is we'll each volunteer one by one to take a moment in the spotlight. Once you've made that decision, once you've volunteered, what I'm going to do is get Sue to deal out 2 cards for the throne. You can then, as the thief, describe a burst of action in the escape. You've got total narrative control, just go for it. And then when you're ready, play the card from your hand. As usual, the goal is to beat the highest throne card. In the getaway, ties go to us, the thieves, because we now have the giant robot. If you wish, you can incorporate one of the powered up systems into your narration and take the card off that system and add it to your total. So combine total against the highest throne card. So that might get you over the line if what you've got in your hand is absolute garbage. And as a reminder, we have a seven of hearts on the Primaris device, and we have an ace of hearts on Ibbot's defense protocols. Aces are high, so that's worth 14. If you pull that one into your hand, you're guaranteed to make a getaway. So, time for the action. Does anybody want to go first? I'm happy to do it if nobody else does.
So, I was going to say, I'm happy to go first, but my hand is garbage, and it would mean that I would be taking a card if I wanted to survive.
My situation is not dissimilar.
Fair to say, mine also is not.
Okay, well, so really, it's a matter of tussling for who goes to go first in order to make use of the devices in order to live.
Who desperately wants to make a getaway?
You go first, Nick.
I'll go first. Cool. Okay, Sue, will you deal me 2 cards? Oh, it's a 3 and a 3.
You're welcome.
How garbage is your hand?
It's pretty darn garbage. And this, of course, is the beauty, right? I can see those cards. I know how this is going to play out. All right, so we've activated Ibbot's defense protocols, and I think there's a command chair in the center of this deck, this command deck on board Tensword. And I think Finch, who is slight, especially next to the hulking Dimitri, scurries over to the command chair and lowers himself into it. And we smash cut to a warehouse somewhere in the past. Flashback. It's black and white so that you know it's a flashback. And there's a cobbled together chair in a warehouse. And Finch is sitting in that cobbled together chair in the warehouse. And he says, Larrick, I don't know why you're making me do this. Surely this is going to be your job.
But it's just good to have a backup, just in case. Of course I'm going to be there, but we have to plan for every eventuality. Plus, I get to show you what an awesome teacher I am as well as a pilot.
Don't doubt it for a second, but I'm never going to be half the pilot you are.
Well, you won't need to be.
Smash cut back to the present when Tensord lurches into motion, and it doesn't look pretty. I'm not even sure. Maybe some sort of helmet lowers down onto Finch's head, covering over his eyes so that he can't see anything except what the throne is seeing. And the throne lurches into motion with this. We've got 4 swords, I think, that we secured that are now circling the throne as part of Ibbot's defense protocols. And so he lurches into motion and starts to run through the harbor. He's heading towards the gate in Tensword. And previously we met hard light versions of Tensword, hard light decoys, which were disrupted in a previous scene. I think they're back to full strength. And so Tensword barrels forward under Finch's command, straight at one of these hard light constructs, expecting to go through it, but it doesn't work that way. He smashes into it. The throne stumbles and starts to fall. And I'm going to play the card from my hand and then carry on with a bit more narration. The card from my hand is a 2.
What the fuck?
Currently failing. And so, Josh, I think as the throne spins and starts to tumble, Finch calls, Jones, we could really use that device of yours. What does it do?
So what's the situation? The throne is stumbling and you expect me to just fix it by activating the Primaris? Is that it?
I absolutely do, yes.
The Primaris had better be something good.
Please note that the Primaris device is not legally related to Primaris Marines of Space.
There are no legal issues with this podcast whatsoever. I don't want it to just be the same as the Omega 13, so it's going to have to be something different. Okay, I think I have an idea. So Jones reaches for his comm with Lieutenant whoever it was that we sent down.
Blight, I think.
Blight.
Yep, Silvarus Blight.
Did we really want to send Blight down to do this? That feels like a bad call. Nevertheless, it's too late now. They're gone. Blight, are you down there yet?
Yes, sir.
Then do it. Activate the Primaris. We don't have a lot of time. And I guess we'll cut to the Primaris itself, which is like this scintillating triple helix of silvery stuff. I mean, it just looks like a cool sculpture, right? Until it starts to spin, and then like the three helices sort of start to spin around each other, enfold each other, and just generally do a kind of cool super disco ball type effect, light shimmering all over the chamber while Lieutenant Blight looks on in a kind of have I just sealed my own death warrant kind of facial expression. And what we then see is a sequence of like separate, I'm going to go back to my favorite analogy in role playing, which is comic book. So we get like a multi-panel page in which the same scene is playing out very slightly differently, and different things are happening, all of which involve the Tensor charging towards its hard light opposite. In one, we see it plunge in and stumble over, but in another, we see it step to one side and sweep its sword down. In a third, the hard light hologram sticks out its sword and runs Tensor through as it charges on, and so on and so on.
I think maybe in a fourth, it's actually Larrick in the chair, not Finch.
It definitely is, yeah. And then smashed into the middle is a single smash-shaped panel in which Tensor just vaults over the top of the hard light version of itself and then plunges its sword through from behind. And then it all collapses down and we're in that reality now.
And that's the reality. Nice. So I'm taking that 7, whacking it in my hand, and that beats the 3s. I'm free. I made it out. Who's next?
I'll go next. Hit me with some cards, see?
What have we got there?
I mean, I guess if you're going to fail anyway, then it is a good job that we're cleaning out the high cards from the deck.
Well, you know, there's an ace on the table.
True.
But I don't think I'm going to take it.
What?
The throne is holding a 6 and a king, which is rough. Only a king or an ace will beat that.
Yes. Shall I show you the card that I have, everybody? For the listeners, I've just put a 2 down.
So, if you can't beat the throne, then that means you're going out in a blaze of glory.
I am going to go out in a blaze of glory. I've decided I'm going to leave that ace for one of the others to take, because I love going out in a blaze of glory. Datura Pandemonium is hooked into Tensword. Not into the flight deck or the kind of the controls for moving it around, but into its secure defense systems. Because ever since you got on board, House Tetsudo have been trying to hack into this system, to hack back into it and gain control remotely. And Datura Pandemonium's job, which we all knew was coming because we've trained for this and we knew it was a possibility, has been to jack their brain into the system and run defensive programs. The problem is that the defensive programs aren't enough. Whether a piece of information was missing about the capabilities of the house, whether they are throwing everything at this in a last ditch attempt and they're committing far more resources than was expected, they are much closer to breaking through the defensive programs that we're running than we want them to be. And so Datura Pandemonium is going to go out in a blaze of glory by using their own brain as the last defensive membrane. Oh, sorry, it's the last defensive wall which gives you just enough time to get out of range of their hacking attempts before they break through the final defence. But the final defence is Datura Pandemonium's brain.
No.
So when it gets broken through, she is no more. And her personality has been completely obliterated. And her brain.
Two down. I'm imagining on the heads-up display that Finch is looking through while he pilots the thing, that a little heartbeat flatlines.
Yeah. Or brainwave goes flatline.
Mm. But you got us clear.
I did get you clear.
Who's next?
I can go. Okay, so we deal cards before we narrate, right?
You get to see what the Thrones cards are, so you know what's coming. Yep.
Okay.
Pair of jacks.
Oh dear.
So yeah, we're firing the retro rockets on Ten Sword and launching from the ground, you know, dripping water behind us as we launch from the bay. But the last of the hard light holograms, its, you know, drone projector still inside it, is rising up to meet us. And Dmitri Rostov flips open the control panel inside his wrists and pairs his wrist Bluetooth with the Bluetooth of Ten Sword, for he is trained in the control of Ibbet's defense protocols. And he steps into the ring of the piloter. You know, Finch is still sort of piloting the machine itself, but now once again, just as when he was having his fight back in the dock area, using miniaturized Ibbet's defense protocols, his gestures control macro Ibbet's defense protocols. And so, you know, he's doing this elaborate series of dance-like gestures, and, you know, as he twitches his arm one way, the multiple swords that we have obtained in our adventures dance in response around him. And the hard light hologram, being massless, it's quick. So Dmitri is straining. He's laying down his card of a four, which would not be the jacks. Now, on the one hand, I don't want to, you know, it pains me to drain our remaining cards. On the other hand, narratively speaking, the system that we've got the ace on is Ibbet's defense protocols.
You've convinced me, James. Your conscience is clear.
As much as it pains me to burn an ace, I'm going to burn that ace. And say that, you know, with a flurry of weird martial arts dance moves, Avatar The Last Airbender style, he gets those blades twirling. And finally, you know, he's got his Vengeance for Morrigan, or whatever it was, tattoo on his chest. And the blade that killed Morrigan, the Eclipsing Revenant sword, plunges into the heart of the hard light hologram, shattering its control drone. And it bursts apart in 1,000 rainbow sparkles and plunges back, burning up in the atmosphere as Ten Sword rises into space. Surely nothing can stop us now!
Yay!
Woohoo!
Dmitri makes it out alive. We have one thief remaining.
This is tense. Oh, I don't believe it!
Oh, I'm so close.
Oh, no!
A two and an ace. The only way I could win is if I have an ace in my hand. Well.
I like that smirk on your face.
Amidst all this action, Monoceros Jones has been rather quiet. And as the mech shoots into orbit, I guess Finch probably says, "All right, looks like we made it." And there's high fives all around, and everyone's kind of looking around, and they're like, hang on a minute, where's Jones? And then we cut to Jones frantically climbing down like a Jeffrey's tube, and he emerges into the chamber of the Primaris. And he says, "Lieutenant, I hope you got that thing set up and ready to go, because we're going to need to punch it up to 11 if we're going to make this thing work." And they turn some sort of weird alien-looking dial and then activate the Primaris for a second time. And then they're just kind of standing around for a moment, just kind of waiting. And the lieutenant says, "The test run seemed to go well, sir." And Jones just goes, "Be quiet. I want quiet for this. I want to enjoy this." And the double, triple helixes start to spin, and the panels multiply out, and we see ships arriving into orbit to intercept the mech. We see the mech flying home free to another planet. We see Larrick smoking a massive cigar as she celebrates successfully piloting the mech through a robot minefield. We see all of these things and more. And then on the next page, we see the panels, even more panels. The panels have got tiny and there's all kinds of things that you can't even really make out the detail on. And then another page in which it's just kind of little dots, tiny dots. You can't see anything. And then the smash appears. And the smash, in the smash, Jones's face, a look of horror as, and here's my card.
Oof.
Close but no cigar, the Queen of Spades.
So close.
As the Primaris spins out of control and shifts us to a universe in which Jones, his body, is torn apart at the molecular level and he is destroyed. Or is he? Who knows what happens to people who are torn apart by the Primaris device, but he's never seen again.
It's a bittersweet escape for two of us.
The cards felt like they were against us all game.
Especially in that getaway.
Yeah. I was holding onto that queen the whole time thinking, hee 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 hee, I'm going to do something really cool at the end because I've got the best card. But no.
Those were three excellent blazes of glory. Three down.
Do love a blaze of glory.
2 out of 5 ain't bad, eh?
It's not bad. Hey, James, we now have an epilogue. We have a finale. You may recall that we settled on 3 reasons to steal the throne.
Yes.
Those 3 reasons were vengeance against House Tetsudo, who had destroyed our homeworld of Morrigan. 1. 2. There was another heist going on at the same time in a Tetsudo pleasure barge that this was all just a massive distraction for. And 3. Somehow, we might be able to use Tensword to resurrect Morrigan, our terribly damaged homeworld. Now, we are now in possession of one of the greatest weapons of war in the galaxy. Gigantic, powerful thing. It brings us all kinds of martial power, but also political power, economic power, whatever we want. Which of those 3 motives is most important to you? Now, we both need to reflect, make a decision about which one we're going to tackle first. I know which one I'm going for. Do you know which one you're going for?
I mean, whilst I have vengeance for Morrigan tattooed on my chest, I feel for sort of poetic storytelling purposes, healing Morrigan might make for the neater ending. But, you know, I don't want to trump your own view of going for that.
No, see, this is the trick, right? We get to find out what Dimitri thinks is most important and what Finch thinks is most important and then reflect on what's going to happen now that we have to work out how to use this gigantic machine. Do we trust each other? Do we not? How quickly is it going to go badly? So what do you reckon? Are you going to... Do you want to save Morrigan?
Yeah. Do I just narrate that or do we discuss that?
No, you just need to make a decision about which one you're after.
I'm going for saving Morrigan.
I'm going for the actual heist. I think the actual target of the heist was a little box in a museum, dark corner of a museum, and that little box has a little symbol on it that looks kind of alarmingly like the triple helix of the Primaris device. So, now between us, privately, and I suppose everybody else can do this too, we can just reflect on whether or not we trust each other, whether or not we think this is going to go well or badly. And that's it. That's the end of the game.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
Oh, we never find out. Oh, man. Well, I think you've got a good chance to save Morrigan now that you've got the Primaris personally. I think that's like I was planning to steal the Primaris if I hadn't drawn that ace. That I think that would have made it harder.
I think it might be interesting to find out who, if we were to try and play a new set of thieves trying to steal Tensword again. Who are we stealing it from this time?
So cool. Well, that was an excellently written game. Just flowed smooth like wine.
Aw. You're very kind. Thank you.
No, seriously, it was really cool. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks everyone. That was really fun.
It was great. I love playing.
I do enjoy a good getaway.
Stealing the blank games. Hey, is the jam still going?
The jam is still going. I don't know when this podcast is going to arrive, but the jam will finish end of March. So there's a little bit of time left as of recording. If you've missed it, there was a jam, a game jam, running on ish.io called Stealing the Jam, where people hacked the game and wrote thrown playsets and all kinds of cool stuff. And you should definitely check it out because, I mean, there's a bunch of really interesting variant heists on there. There is, of course, the one that Josh wrote about stealing some stones.
Stealing Stonehenge.
Some very big stones. But there's a bunch of really cool ones. One actually springs to mind right now. It's called Healing Their Own by Alex Reinhardt. It's about the crack squad sent in after heist goes bad to rescue someone who maybe went out in a blaze of glory. So
that's cool.
To this one to try and get Larrick out or recover Monosaurus Jones from wherever he's ended up. But yeah, bunch of cool stuff. So check it out.
I loved the sound of stealing the crone as well. So
stealing the crone
involving old people is always just really like old people and kids. That's going to be really cool.
It's a real favorite of mine. It's by Logan Timmons, Stealing the Crone. The idea there is that you, the grandchildren, are going to go and bust your grandparent out of the old folks home. Now they're not a prisoner. They love the home. They're very happy there. They just, you know, want to make some mischief. So
is this like a Ferris Bueller Day Off, but with a grandparent?
With a mischievous grandparent, yeah.
That's pretty cool. I like that.
Yeah.
It's amazing how many things rhyme with throne when you come to think about it.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure that there will still be like 2 or 3 weeks left in the jam when this goes out. So you never know. You might get a late entry from somebody if they listen to it real quick.
Plenty of time. A couple of cool throne playsets too. So check it out.
Thank you for listening to Black Armada Tales. We've been playing Stealing the Throne by Nick Bate. If you'd like to find out more about Stealing the Throne, you can go to ickbat.itch.io. That's ickbat.itch.io. And don't forget to rate and review the podcast and join us on Twitter, where we are BArmadaTales. If you're struggling to find a pen to write all that down, you can find that information and more in the show notes. See you next time.
Still, one of my favorite things about driving in this country is all the road signs that say the north and the south.
I love it. It's genuinely helpful, I find.
It's a very loose definition of south, I feel, to be like all in capitals.
Well, it's about whether you're heading towards it, right?
Mm.
Except it's the way it's written. If it just said the south, like, this is the south, that's the north, fine. But it doesn't. It says the south.
Yeah, all caps.
Yeah.
The signs caps, shout at you. Do they have those for the West? People who
the
know
West.
What the West is like. People from the West. I count Bristol as West, see?
There's the Southwest. I think you get the Southwest, the but Southwest. Not in all caps. Yeah, it's just the Southwest. Yay! that kind of vibe.
There is no West, is there? Like, West is basically Wales.
Wales. Then you have signs to Wales, I guess. I can't remember that.
But there is an east.
Is there?
Yeah, there's the east of England, isn't there?
Yeah, but I've not seen road signs saying this way to the west, this way to the east.
Yeah, but I mean, there are fewer situations where you'd be driving in that direction.
Yeah, we just drive up and down all the time.
Like, we're a very vertical country.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Sue. That's exactly right.
It just sounded like you were saying, why would anyone want to go west or east anyway? The middle is where it's at, up and down.
You're only going to be heading towards East Anglia if you're going to East Anglia. Right? I mean, you wouldn't... I suppose, arguably, if you're in the southwest and you start driving towards London, you're heading towards the east, but probably they don't signpost that. Whereas with the north, it's like you could be in a number of different places in the country and be heading towards the north.
Every planet's got a north. That was a Doctor Who joke there for the discerning listener.
Don't think it's true.
We all got it.
Why didn't you laugh?
Do you think it's true that every planet's got a north? Is that because it wouldn't have a magnetic core?
Yeah. How are you defining your north?
Culturally.
It's where they got a northern accent, innit? That was the Doctor Who joke, was that every planet's got a north, meaning every planet's got a place where people are bolshy and talk like...
Chris Eccleston at the time.
Yeah.
Checks out.
Underrated Doctor, in my view.
Good actor, but miscast?
Not sure he was miscast. Good actor, but mistreated, I think.
I didn't watch every episode. He was good at, like, if he had to be, you know, angry with the Daleks or something, because, like, depressive and angry, he does well. But if he had to be, like, hey, I'm excited about science, then he's not really as good at that.
I can supply all the excitement about science myself, though. I don't think the Doctor can replicate that for me. Besides, I think that you need to understand that mine and Josh's favourite Doctor, our Doctor, the Doctor we claim as our own, is Sylvester McCoy. So I'm pretty forgiving.
I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're saying, Becky. Sylvester McCoy is awesome.
He is awesome.
So why do you need to say the word forgiving in that sentence?
So I'm going to break a hard, painful truth to you, Josh, but Sylvester McCoy is not as universally loved by the rest of the world as he is in this house.
That is true of many things that are objectively awesome.
No, I know. I honestly think he had some of the best episodes.
The more awesome something is, the more likely it is to be a minority pursuit. Take role-playing, for example.
I think it's fair to say the writing on his run was a little bumpy. There were some high highs.
I mean, when people write about, I saw a few as a kid and maybe a handful later, but the usual critical consensus seemed to be that it improved towards the end, only to be, you know, cruelly cancelled.
Yeah, so somebody started writing Uber plots in the McCoy era. So they started writing, like, serious long-term story arcs that spanned not just multiple episodes, but multiple storylines, and I suspect that's what they're talking about, is it started to get a real kind of sense of holy shit, this is quite something major's going on. And like nowadays, something major's going on means this episode we're wiping out three species instead of only one.
There's some really good stuff. Whereas... I think that Battlefield was an amazing episode or story arc.
Battlefield was superb.
I think The Curse of Fenric was absolutely outstanding.
I'm still waiting for the future Doctor Who episode where we find out which Doctor was Merlin. Because they made a whole thing about how the Doctor was clearly Merlin and had been at some point in his past or future.
Future, it was future iteration of the Doctor was Merlin.
Well, we don't know. It had never seemingly happened.
No, he says it must have been a future version of me. In the episode.
I think he said in the future, maybe that, well, anyway, whatever. And the point being, we don't know when it happens or will happen. And I'm waiting for somebody to pick up that thread and make it happen unexpectedly.
So, BBC, if you're listening to this, Russell T. Davis, you're coming back as showrunner, and there's absolutely every chance you wish and listen to this podcast. So, Russell T. Davis, go back, watch Battlefield. The episode of Sylvester McCoy's era. Look at the bit where it talks about the Doctor being Merlin in a future incarnation and make that happen for us.
Russell T. Davis, how come your show about Jeremy Thorpe affair was good when all your Doctor Who scripts were the most awful panto shite? Explain.
A bit harsh.
Is the good Russell T. Davis or the bad Russell T. Davis going to be coming back for this one?
He's a great showrunner.
God, I hope so. I hope we don't find out in 10 years' time that actually he's a fascist or something.
Everyone gets cancelled one by one.
Sooner or later.
It's just a matter of why.